This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 235, and I'm your host Simon Bowne. My book, titled Aspects of Alien Abduction, has been published, and you can get it on paperback, audiobook or Kindle on Amazon. And the audiobook is also available on Spotify. This week, I'm talking to Brian Martin about his book, Between Worlds, A Life of Abduction, Addiction and Awakening. Brian is a Literary Titan Award winner, and he has had lifelong encounters with non-human intelligence. Hi, Brian. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Hi, Simon. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks a lot for coming on. We're going to talk about your book. It's called Between Worlds, A Life of Abduction, Addiction and Awakening.
Well, thank you, Simon, very much for the opportunity to be here and to discuss some of our favorite topic matters, and one of which of mine is indeed my book. Thank you very much.
Can you tell us, what is your earliest memory of contact?
I just had that conversation with someone, and this is something that's not included in the book. When I was roughly around 2 years old, maybe three at the most, I was introduced to my grandparents on my father's side for the first time. And I have seven uncles, one of which was only 2 years older than me. And when we shared the bed that evening, you know, they put us in the same bedroom because we were so close in age. We had an encounter, and it was a little spooky. As a young child, very impressionable, you know, the only thing I could really equate it to was a fairy tale monster of some sort, a troll maybe. And it was a gray, and it was a gray of somewhat of athletic build. And, you know, he looked big to me at the time, mind you. And, but it was a typically sized gray, somewhere between 3 and 4 feet tall. Like I said, athletically built, and a large round head, big black, deeply black eyes. And his statement to me, because I don't think he was expecting me to be there, was, "Who are you?" And I did not feel like answering, Simon, to be perfectly honest. And I was going to wake up my uncle, and he was stubbornly asleep. His face was tense. His teeth were actually bared. But he wanted to wake up, but could not. And again, this other put the question to me, "Who are you?" And I did not want to have any conversation with him. And it was my very first encounter. He did leave the room and then reapproached me later. And I was just desperate to get rid of him in any way I could. So I actually started trying to give him information, and it was telepathically transmitted. I have to say that I answered him with thoughts. I was too scared to actually talk, and he seemed to pick up on the thoughts just fine. But I tried to answer him as best I could. I tried to tell him that I was my father's son. And, you know, at that time, dad was dad. I didn't have any other name for dad than dad. And there was a little bit of confusion as to who dad was, but I was finally able to communicate that dad was the oldest of all the boys in that family. And that seemed to cinch the deal. And there was a period of calmness during this exchange. It happened after he left initially and then came back. I can't explain why there was a wave of calmness that was to come over me, other than I think that he might have just flipped a switch to try and make way for the information to be able to reapproach me. I think that I was calmed, if you will.
Do you think that it was there for your uncle, like some kind of abduction?
That's exactly what I think.
Do you know if your uncle remembered any of that?
No, he did not have any recollection the next morning. I asked him and I expressed to him, and he was 4 years old. I expressed to him that somebody had come into the room. Did he remember somebody coming into the room? And he started listing off a whole bunch of names, all the different uncles, you know, whom I had yet to meet, basically. And I'm like, no, wasn't, you know, because it wasn't a person. It wasn't a human person. So he did not have any recollection.
So after that, then the ETs had met you and worked out who you are. So is it that then after that, when was the next encounter? Did it start happening regularly?
Honestly, that was a recent memory that had come back just a few months back. I was at a camping event, and something happened to trigger that memory at that camping event. But my next recollection of a period of encounters would be in the 70s, after I was right around 9-10 years old and stuff. And I'd like to go ahead and, if you don't mind, Simon, I'd like to read something in the way of proof to you and your readers. I know that you would like to have that. And in my book, I do offer a modicum of proof. And it says, to you, the reader, I offer this small bit of stability. I have paid out of my own pocket to acquire a polygraph exam of reputable company and examiner, and was quite lucky to have done so. First, these guys aren't cheap, and I'm not rich. Second, the examiners in North America, of which there are about 3,000, are somewhat of a good boys club, good old boys club, many of whom are or were a part of government agencies or law enforcement. I found the youngest one purely by chance, and Providence led me to the most open-minded regarding the subject matter. You see, these guys often turn down more work than is requested of them. Also, please consider that this exam differs greatly from what you see on TV screens. They are not a series of 100 questions with thumbs up and down signals given. They are extremely easy to fail. I had no guarantee this would be to my advantage. Trust me when I tell you there was a 7-year attempt to write a manuscript whose many versions never breached the 65,000 word ceiling. This is what fought to be written. In 2020, I was triggered and wrote a 90,000 word piece in 6 months, followed by a 6-year plus endeavor to polish it to professional perfection. Considering expenses and outside editing, it is safe to say I do not expect to gain profit from securing this examination. To my publisher, and I am self-published at this with Defiance Press, the examination will be available in confidentiality for proof of verification to the readership. This is a personal issue examination, the basis for which was a single issue statement verification test. I claimed the pretest to have been visited by EBEs, or extraterrestrial biological entities, on multiple occasions through the 70s and several encounters in the 90s as well, stating that I was taken up to their ship and had even seen the earth from above. Also, that I felt, turning the page here, that I experienced their technology many times, and that they had the ability to return me to my home and bedroom, making it seem like a dream. But I was able to recall too many significant facets of each occasion. Each experience was vivid and detailed, and I felt in my heart that they were 100% real. Based on my denials, a single issue examination was constructed and administered to determine truthfulness. The following three questions, slightly reworded regarding the single issue, were constructed using the Utah 3CQT version test and asked while psychological data was acquired, that being 5.5 hours of interview on a recorded thing. Did you lie when you said that you were taken aboard the ships with EBEs? The response was no. Did you lie when you said that you had met multiple EBEs, multiple in number and type? The response again was no. Did you lie when you said that you had seen the earth from above in the ship? The response, no. results, no deception indicated. And thank you for letting me read that. But it kind of encapsulates the periods of time that were most active. This is an ongoing thing with me. I've struggled to come to grips with it. I have come to grips with it. I am more stable now with this concept, with these others, with these visitations than I've ever been in my entire life. I have suffered through addictive periods of my life. I am now recovered by 21 years, I'm very happy to say. I'm very open to this. I think of them, even though it has not always been a pleasant experience, I think of them as brothers and sisters. I think that this is significant, not just to me, but to everyone, especially during these very unusual times in our life, to be able to turn towards the sky and have these, have this awareness expanded for all of us at the same time with all the things that are dividing us right now that this is happening. I think it's fantastic.
I wanted to ask, could you give us an example of one of the encounters when you were 9 or 10 years old, like how they picked you up, if you were on a craft, or what happened on the craft?
Oftentimes, I've had a lot of time to think about this. I believe that I was kind of a willing participant in a certain way because of the trauma that was going on in my home life. I was open to these kinds of visitations. I think that they tailored them to me specifically and how it was encountered. And in one of the very first recognizable, easily remembered encounters for me, unlike the very first one that I said earlier, that took a long time to come to the surface, that very first earliest encounter. But when I was in that age, I remember waking up on a table, a very form-fitting table. It wasn't uncomfortable. It wasn't cold. It was in a dark room. There was enough ambient light from the panel to the side of the table that I could see the immediate area around us, us being me and a rather doctor-like figure, but another gray. He was older. He seemed older. He moved very fast, though. He had an amazing alacrity of dexterity. He was very businesslike, and I was absolutely fascinated. I have to tell you, I wasn't scared. I didn't feel any need to jump off the table and run off into the darkness. I was not bound in any way. I was just absolutely fascinated. There was this otherworldly being right there beside me, prepping things, getting things ready. Who knows what? I couldn't see all what he was doing. And he noticed me. He noticed me looking at him, and he said, "You look at my face." And he said it verbally. He said it verbally, but our conversation would become more telepathic towards the end of the encounter. And it was not all pleasant either, as you can well imagine. These things, I was probed, and it was hurtful. It hurt. I felt that it was done despite my clear efforts that I did not want it done. And I think that the fear was part of the reaction that they wanted. And I think that my communication with them telepathically was something that they were measuring as well at that very moment. I think that there's multiple reasons why they do such things, and I don't pretend to understand what they all are. That was the one and only physical altercation that actually caused me pain, physical pain. Everything subsequent to that point afterwards, there was no pain ever, not in any of the encounters. a lot of times the inside of the ship, when I was able to see it, when I wasn't in a dark room in a spotlight situation, the ship was anywhere from, the interior walls were rounded. There were no corners per se. If there was a place to lay down, it usually was attached to a wall, a shelf, if you will. And there wasn't any real squareness to these interiors. There wasn't like a square room or a rectangular room. These were odd shaped rooms, as you might expect to find in a ship situation. And the metal was anywhere from dark metallic gray to a rather silverish white. And there was no lights that I can recall seeing. There was no central lighting. There was no lamp in the corner. There was just this light. And I did notice that the light seemed to be coming from the walls itself, probably. The color and texture seemed to change with the level of light. The darker the light, the darker the metal. The lighter the light, the lighter the metal. But there was no light source. And everything, if there was a bed, it was molded into the floor and molded into the wall. And if it was just a shelf to lay on, it was, as I said, you know, just kind of jutting out from the wall, or a place to sit jutting out from the wall. The doors did slide open. There was always a sort of a Under Armour type branding uniform, but it wasn't branded like Under Armour, but it just reminded me of Under Armour, you know. And I of course didn't see Under Armour until decades later, but just like the lights in that very first encounter were different than anything I'd seen at that time. But later on, with the advent of LED lighting, I would recognize that intensity with the lights on that particular thing. And there was a lot of questions. Sometimes I was in the dark and just being asked questions, and I remember being very, very zoned out during these sessions. And I think it would be very safe to say that they know me better than I know myself at this point in the game, because they submitted me to many, many sessions of questions. And anytime there was something that was unusual, at least to them, they would raise my conscious level up to where I was aware of what I was participating in. Sometimes it was very, like I said, very dreamlike. Other times it was very, very clear. And I remember one visitation shortly after the very first, I was sitting across from said Dr. Gray figure. And I can't remember if there was a table between us or not. I just know that we were both sitting and we were both facing each other. And I felt so sleepy initially, so out of it, so not quite there. Like I just couldn't quite make myself wake up enough to focus on who was in front of me. But eventually, as the conversation between us went, I was able to finally recognize who it was that I'd seen them before. And this was one of the figures that I would see, this doctor figure that I would see on multiple occasions. And like I said, there was multiple alien type figures that I would see on a regular basis, one of which I call the Kind One. And he looked like a human gray hybrid, more human than gray, and definitely with more human-like proportions. He had very albino kind of features with very pale skin. He had black eyes. He had close-cropped white hair. And he was my age. He was much more taller than I was, more athletic, And there were these long, tall grays that I call the angulars in my book. I refer to all of them as the others. And then there are some that I remember meeting on multiple occasions, but for the life of me, I can't recall what they look like. And I think that's by design. I think they asked me not to remember, and I was willingly participating in that. And I refer to those as the four. And then there is the one that I refer to as the seraphim, because he was so angelic looking. He was I guess in proper vernacular to the subject, he was a Nordic. But there was always such calm in his presence. I never felt strange or uncomfortable, or that I would ever come to harm while he was there. And in fact, he would always be there the instant things started feeling traumatic of sorts and stuff. And there were traumatic moments. There were interesting times and not so interesting times, and some trauma. But for the most part, I think I feel very, very lucky that they're as interested in me and us as we seem to be in them. And I think that really speaks volumes for their motivation. And I don't think that they're here to save the world per se. I think they would like to facilitate us in our endeavors as people, as stewards of our own planet. I think they care about us very much as we would care about others who need help. You know, I think they recognize that we are in need, and they would like to do more, but they're not going to interfere with us unless, you know, it is clearly invited or well, I might be overspeaking on that one, but where should we pick up now?
Talking about the interior of the craft, I just wanted to ask, was there any smell?
No, I don't recall smells. I know a lot of people do. The best I can offer is that it felt metallic under my feet. I remember that when I dropped something, it had a metallic clang when it hit. It didn't necessarily always look like metal floors or metal walls, you know, but it most definitely sounded like metal whenever something clanged against it. And it felt like metal underneath my feet. It wasn't per se cold or uncomfortable, but it was definitely, you know, just as you would know you were walking on a tile floor, I could tell I was walking on a metal surface. And oftentimes I was barefoot, you know, oftentimes I was just in my underwear in those times, you know, because I was taken right out of bed.
You said the doctor talked to you. It wasn't telepathy.
He used both telepathy and he did speak with me verbally. Absolutely, he did. There was both kinds of communication there. Yes, Simon.
If he talked to you, did he have an accent?
He most certainly did have an accent. And it was not something... I was raised in Iowa, Simon, in a very small town in Iowa. And I was not familiar with many races or anything like that. I lived in a little small town filled with white people and farmers. And I, the first black person that I met was in Des Moines when I was in my early teens. I did not meet a black person up until that point. The first Mexican or Hispanic person that I had met was a foreign exchange student. I was very sheltered. I was in a very small town in Iowa when I was growing up. And this accent, as I would grow up later and become more worldly and more familiar with these things and stuff, I would have to say it had an Asian kind of accent to it. It sounded Asian to me. And what kind of Asian, I could not tell you, Simon, but, you know, thinking back, it is like, "You look at my face," is kind of how he said it. It sounded Asian to me. And it just had that lilt, that tip to it.
He said something like, "You look at my face and you think my voice is funny."
I just couldn't stop staring. Unlike when you pray to God, God doesn't appear usually unless you're a saint or some miraculous thing is happening with you, you know. But all of a sudden, I am face to face with things that I've heard about. And there it was in the flesh right in front of me. And he was busy. I barely was there to him, it seemed. And then all of a sudden he caught me looking at him and said, "You look at my face." And I was just fascinated. I was curious. I was fascinated. And when I look back to that encounter, Simon, you have to understand, I again feel like I was emotionally modified at that point in the game. I was being given support emotionally. I did not feel the need to be afraid. I did not feel the need to jump off the table and run away. I felt pretty calm, calm enough to be curious, calm enough to be able to stare openly. And I was a very shy child, very shy. And I was just staring, just open-faced at this amazing creature. I just couldn't believe that I was seeing. And I was so happy to see it. You know, it was just so fascinating to me as a child. And later on during that encounter, those emotional supports would be taken away from me, which is what led me to believe they wanted me to feel the fear. So what happened specifically? I think I need to be specific at this point in the game. What happened was I felt this emotional support and we had a verbal conversation, very short, very brief. And then he went right back to what he was doing. And then eventually he pulls out two instruments. One is a little bit larger than the other. Both of them have frosted, clear, kind of orchid-like ends on them. And he's looking at them and he's looking at me as if he's trying to decide which one would better fit me, because I was a very, very small child. I was very slight, so thin, so painfully thin, you might have thought I was sick or sickly. And I was not. I was just a really skinny kid. But I was not at all happy with this intense discernment he was giving both me and these instruments. I did not like where this was going. And I felt the emotional support being flowed away from me. Like if I were standing on the beach and you're standing on the sand, the wet sand feels nice and firm, and then the water flows away from you. And all of a sudden the sand becomes mushy and not so stable, and you're not on stable foundation anymore. That is what it felt like emotionally. I felt like the support was gone. I felt like I was no longer on stable ground emotionally. And I felt a lot more normal in my reaction. I felt a lot more in control normally. I did not feel the need to scream, though. I felt that my face and my eyes and my concern were plain to be seen. I really did not want where this was going. I really did not want it. I did not think that I had any issues conveying this to them, even though I didn't say anything at that particular moment. And yet, the experiment was carried out. I was still probed. It hurt horribly, Simon. It was horrible. It was like lightning shot through my guts. It was awful. And I was mad. I was absolutely mad that they did this to me. I was so mad. And I remember after I could get over the pain, I glared at him and I directed my thought to him and I said, "I will remember you. I will remember you and all of your kind. I will remember this and I will never forget you." And he looked embarrassed. He looked embarrassed. He held up a hand towards me as if to pat the air between us. And like, okay, was the body language, you know? And then he placed before I knew it, like I said, he was very fast. His dexterity was amazing. And before I knew it, he had placed a cup-like thing over my genitalia. And there was this, and I had semen extracted from me. It was just that fast. It wasn't like an orgasm that you would have during sex. You know, it was just this, but there was a certain endorphin release during it. I do remember that. And it did lessen the pain that was still fading at that point in the game. But I think that they were quite happy with my projection as much as they were with whatever other reasons they perform such tests. I do remember he said something to me telepathically. I just can't recall what it was right this very second. That might be by design as well. But does that answer your question, Simon?
When I saw you in an interview before, I think you said the doctor looked across your body and addressed the darkness like there were other entities there.
That's true. That's absolutely true. He addressed me first by saying, "You look at my face." And then he did that a second time verbally. He said something else that I did not recognize as our language, but he was literally looking over me, over the table, into the darkness beyond to my left. And he was definitely talking to someone. You know, we were not alone in that room. And at the end of that encounter that I described, after what was done, there was the kind one that I saw for the first time, the one that I refer to as the hybrid human gray. And like I said, he was my age. He came out of the darkness and confirmed my suspicion that the doctor figure was addressing somebody else. So indeed, there was someone else in that room. And a lot of the time, Simon, I have to tell you, there was always a feeling that there was some voyeuristic kind of, you know, attention or audience going on. You know, it seldom was just the people that was seen. I always felt that me, the situation, those who were with me, all of us were actually monitored, whatever the situation was. I really felt like there was much, much more going on than what was just available to the naked eye, you know. And that was one of the first encounters and one of the first confirmations of such other audiences there in the dark, or that feeling of more people there than what you see. There was always something like that going on.
There's this kind of representation of the Greys as they're all clones. They're all identical and very smooth skinned. Mm. But when you studied his face, did you see lots of wrinkles? And it's like they're just as different as we are, different looking people.
Well, actually, I do find that there are differences between them. I don't get the clone thing. I don't get the clone thing. I think that they have the same kinds of differences that we have. They have differences of height. They have differences of weight. Their skin texture is very smooth. The doctor figure was more sallow-cheeked, not necessarily wrinkled, but more sallow-cheeked. His eyes were a little more sunken around the edges, even though they were enormous. And there was a certain roll forward to his shoulders, as older people are often a little more bent forward. You know, he had a little bit of that going on. Not as much for someone of his apparent age, though, you know, because he did strike me as an older individual, you know, not middle age, but old. And I had an opportunity at one point in the game to see a whole room full of grays and hybrids. There was definitely over 10 within the room. And some of them had a little pot belly. Some of them were just exactly my size. You know, some of them were cuter than others. They were just kind of cartoonish and cute. Others, not so much. Like I said, that very first one had a very severe troll-like athleticism to him. You know, but they were all black-eyed, big black eyes, you know, except for the hybrids. I'm speaking strictly of the grays now. They all had the big, deeply black eyes, huge eyes that you just fell into. I don't recall a reflection in them, but they seemed glossy. They seemed like you could just fall right on into them. And through many occasions, I felt that they often wanted you to look into their eyes. They wanted that kind of contact. I think it makes things easier for them telepathically. I think that they want that kind of contact. Their skin is very smooth. It does have folded wrinkles around eyes and what little mouth they have. I don't recall any ears per se. There might have been some indentations there. I don't recall ears. They had very small noses. But their features definitely varied, just as they do between people. You know, some of us are heavier, some of us are taller, some of us are broader, you know. And there definitely was some, depending on what they were doing, posture stances and body English that was individual. I would even go as far as to say individual to the character. One of the grays that I refer to as the minder was, like I said, he was just my height exactly. And it was awfully hard to not stare at him because, you know, after you look into their eyes for a little while, it gets kind of uncomfortable. They're just so huge and so different, you know, and his head was so large, and that little slit of a mouth, and you know, you after you're done looking, you just kind of like, oh, okay, I'll hold the conversation, but I'm not necessarily going to look at your face. But he was rather cute. The one that I considered my favorite minder, the one that led me to many places and put me to many tasks, whether it be the series of questions or the sessions of questions or other things.
So what was the purpose of being in that room with all of those greys? Was it they just happened to be there, or was it for a reason?
There was a reason. There was a reason. And I do remember it. It's a little complicated, but I'll do my best for you. The kind one told me something that I don't think he should have told me. I think he misspoke. It caused something of an existential crisis for me. I was very, very traumatized by it. There was another gray that would be involved, and I was forced into unconsciousness. I actually was attacked in that situation. Without getting into too much details, because I'm trying to keep it simple. But I would later be encountered or visited by the doctor figure. And we were in an office setting at this point in the game. It seemed like an office. It was still within the ship, but it seemed like his office setting. Again, the rounded corners. But there was a desk, and I was sitting on the other side of it. And he was speaking to me about the kind one not wanting to carry on. He was feeling suicidal. And because of the attempt made on my life. And there was some confusion as to what the story was. But the conveyance was it would be an awful waste, you know, for him to end his life. And I wasn't willing to see him again. I didn't want, you know, because that was an option given to me. You don't have to have this person within your presence again because an attempt had been made on your life. And I said, that sounds great. And I just immediately agreed to that. I said, that's fine. Let's not have them or anybody connected to them near me ever, ever, ever again. I think that's fantastic. But every time I disagreed, he would put me under telepathically. And then he would reapproach me with the same set of questions. You know, would I be willing to show that, you know, I was okay, be within this person's presence again? And even though he wasn't the one who attacked me, for some reason, the doctor felt that he had been the one that attacked me. So the story was confused. Somebody wasn't telling someone the whole truth here. And I didn't, I was afraid to contradict anything that was put before me. So I was just rolling with the story as it was being presented to me. And I said to this guy, I said, well, do you ever have a protocol where the person who, like me, who is brought, gets to meet all those who are in contact with him while I'm being brought here? And he said, no, we don't do anything like that. I'm like, well, if you did, then I would be there in a large crowd and he would be able to see me, that I was fine, that I was alive, because apparently he didn't know I was alive. Last time he saw me, he thought I'd been killed, which is why he was suicidal. And I know it's a very hard, it's such a strange story to tell without the context of all the details around it. But that is the long and short of it. All of a sudden, I was in order to agree to this, I wanted to be around a lot of people. I wanted there to be a certain safety in numbers situation. So nothing like that could happen. I knew that the kind one, who I refer to as the kind one, hadn't actually done the attacking. It was the other gray. And I don't know why he was covering for the other one. I can only guess, but so I really didn't have too much fear of him. I just didn't want to be near any of this situation because an attempt had been made on my life. I was once bitten, twice shy. I didn't want to go back into that company again. And, you know, and if one thing I can be clearer about on what the existential crisis was, I actually feel like I had been teleported at one point in the game and he had advised me not to do that. And when I inquired why, he told me that it's, in essence, it's sort of like dying. And it was all very confusing. I was very, very young. And it sent me into an existential crisis because I was like, well, if I died, then what happened? You know, I didn't know what the rules were. I'm on an alien ship. I'm surrounded by aliens. This was all a bit much for me. So that was what the existential crisis was about. I wanted to be around as many people as possible the next time I was within his presence. That's why I got to see so many of them at once.
So with the attempt on your life, are you okay to describe what happened there?
Well, I can, absolutely. Like I said, I was with the kind one. It was an encounter where I was brought to in this room with this individual, this hybrid, and it was like an interview. He was asking, what could you do for us? Because I was very, very much at that point in the game interested in being a part of this wonderful, interesting thing that was going on. I wanted to be as close to it as possible. I had a traumatic life at home. I very much was enjoying this encounter and these experiences. I was actually wanting to do more. And he's like, well, what could you actually do for us? And I would in turn say, I'm not sure, but I know that I could be of use. I know that I would help do good, whatever that is. And then he would counter. And by the way, I don't think you should allow yourself to be teleported again. And that was, I'm kind of paraphrasing here because I don't remember the exact words that were said, but I remember that he told me that it was life altering. He insinuated that it was sort of like dying. And, you know, as a child, I had, and still do, have a very strong religious belief in God. And I wasn't familiar with the concept of near-death experiences or what happens to a person when they die and come back. And it was all a little bit more sophisticated than my thinking at that point in the game. And I just felt that this was something that affected me religiously. It affected my belief system at that time, and sent me into this, like I said, this existential crisis as to what happened to my soul. What is going on with that? What is going on there? What happens with me as you know, perhaps it made me rethink everything I was there for. It made me rethink everything that I thought I was motivated to do for them. It made me rethink everything right then, right there. And I freaked out. I didn't necessarily panic in a way that I was gesticulating or physical or anything like that. However, I was able to turn my back on the kind one, and I shed that emotional support or motivation or grip that they had on me. I was actually able to shove it off like dropping a cloak off of my shoulders or dropping a robe off of my back. I was able to turn my back on him, shed their influence on me emotionally, and just deal with what I was trying to deal with. Well, obviously this is not how their interviews usually go. This is something that was not regular in the way that these kinds of things happen for them. And that is why I am guessing here, Simon. I am just guessing because I don't know anything. I'm just someone who's had an awful long time to think about these things. But we were joined in that room by another gray. I think he was summoned because things had gone so out of whack with that interview. And honestly, I was very suicidal. I did not know who I was. I did not know what the state of my soul was. I did not know whether or not I wanted to be a participant, a willing participant where I was being altered in ways and changed in ways that I did not understand. And I did not know if this was something I wanted to, I didn't know if it went with my religion or against my religion, or if it went against God. Like I said, it was very much an existential crisis. I was so traumatized with this news that I had actually perished, and I had gotten some telepathic, confirmation on what he was telling me, because I wanted, before the other gray came in, I wanted to know what he was thinking, why he was thinking that. I was trying so hard. So I did open myself back up to him. I did turn around to the kind one and I opened myself back up to him. I said, I don't know how to see what you're thinking, and I need you to help guide me so I can understand what it is that you're telling me about me actually dying. And the experiment with him letting me see within him was enough for me to understand that, scientifically speaking, when you teleport, you are not the same person when you arrive on the other side. You know, that is just what I was able to understand. That much I was able to get, that much I was able to get confirmation on. And And then just as soon as I was done with that, and it was uncomfortable, it felt dirty, it felt weird. And when I was done with that, I shed that connection again, just like I did the first time. But then the other gray came into the room, and there was an exchange between the kind one and him. And it was very interesting. I was actually able to take myself out of self for a second because I was so fascinated with the interaction that was going on between those two. There seemed to be a relationship between those two that was perhaps maybe even intimate. I'm not sure. But there seemed to be a bit of an exchange going on between them. And I have to say, I had a certain voyeuristic impulse going on that was able to take me out of my existential crisis for a little bit. And then he turned on me, the gray, he turned on me very viciously, might I add, and said, "So you want to die?" And then he overpowered me and he pushed me under consciousness. And then I fought it initially. And then because of my inclination of what I had gone through, I just let it happen. I let it happen. And then later on, I would come to at the next visitation in the doctor's office. And I apologize to you and I apologize to your listeners too. I know how horribly convoluted this must sound without the context of being able to read it. You have to realize that I took a lot of time when I put my book together, so it wouldn't be so disjointed as I've discussed it. I hope that you understand at least where I'm coming from with these shorter versions of trying to explain what happened and how it happened and what my emotional state was.
So I wanted to ask about other stuff that happened, because you've talked before about how you met the Four, and is it you found yourself being wheeled down a hall on a gurney?
Oh, well, to the best of my understanding, I wasn't actually being wheeled down those are two separate instances, Simon. Those are two separate instances, Simon. I'm happy to talk about both of them. First, the Four. The Four are the very beings that I referred to earlier that I had an agreement not to remember with. I remember that they were tall. I remember that they were robed. I remember their robes were kind of conical, falling off at the shoulder, being wide at the bottom. I remember feeling them before I saw them. I had about eight minders. I had about eight different grays that would ferry me here and there to whatever task was needed. One that I wasn't very familiar with was probably taking me to, it felt like we were going to another question answer session. I was going down a hallway, and there was hallways, by the way. There was hallways. I don't remember anything square about them. They were uniform. They were rounded corners. But anyhow, there were hallways. And he was taking me somewhere when my favorite minder, the cute one, interrupted him and us in our journey and said that I had made a big impression on them. And I'm getting confused, Simon. I'm sorry. But
okay.
There was... I was actually being taken to see the Four, and I remember going down the hallway, and I remember feeling their presence. Walking towards the Four was very much like walking towards an ocean. It was amazing. They hummed with this presence of energy. It wasn't a hum in a physical sense. It was just this vibe that hit you, and it was more than one. You could sense that immediately, and you could sense that there was a real justified loftiness to them. You felt like you were in the presence of something very much superior, very, very much superior. And they were very patient with me. I was just a kid. They were very patient with me. I was very happy to experience this, but at the same time, it was kind of terrifying. At the same time, it was like, what do you do with this? This is, there's so much bigger. There's so much presence involved with them. They're so lofty, and yet they want to see me, you know, this little kid. And they informed me that they wanted me to be happy, that I was free to ask questions. Simon, I think that one of our uses to the others is on a physical level. I think that there is something that they can get from us on a physical level. I'm not sure what that is. I know that I was a really big athlete back then. I was a track star. I had very low body fat. I know they liked my reactions to tests that I performed, to the things that I was done, that were done with me. I overheard one of them say that I tested very high in certain regards, and I have no idea whether that was physical, chemical, mental. I have no idea what it was in reference to, but I think that they were able to get something from me physically. I think that it was valuable to them.
The book's called Between Worlds, A Life of Abduction, Addiction, and Awakening, and that's on Amazon, isn't it?
Indeed it is. And the link that I provided, you can buy it in formats that are audio, in ebook format, and also you can go to Amazon, and you have to, if you look it up on your own phone, you have to remember the whole long name, which is Between Worlds, A Life of Abduction, Addiction, and Awakening. Between Worlds, A Life of Abduction, Addiction, and Awakening. Otherwise, you might not be able to find it. But the link that you will provide your readers also has quick and easy links to where you can purchase these things, Barnes and Noble, Amazon, what have you. And again, Simon, what a treasure you are for the bending over backwards to accommodate my schedule. I so very much appreciate you and the opportunity to share with you and your listeners. Thank you so much for letting me be a part today.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. And that was an interview with Brian Martin about his book, Between Worlds, A Life of Abduction, Addiction, and Awakening. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended version of this episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienUFO podcast. And if you want to try out the extended episodes, you can get a 7-day free trial. Now, my website is simonbound.com. And it's got all the information there on my books, my podcasts, and the hypnotherapy. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.